in the Alaska Environmental Lobby and distributed to members of that committee and to other interested parties both in and outside the legislature. At that meeting, there were a number of people who came to testify. We put out the word as quickly as possible to give our own informal notice that a hearing was being held on this issue. We contacted as many people as we could. Imagine our surprise when we arrived at the meeting to find the entire representative group from the Alaska Oil and Gas Association seated neatly in one row right across the front of the room. And all of the lobbyists from the various extractive mineral industries located in equally good locations for observing the testimony that was about to occur. We put our names on a list, as you're supposed to, as did people from the League of Women Voters, as did several other people in the public interest groups. When we did that, Mr. Chairman, we felt that at least now we would have our chance to address this new bill. Unfortunately, the time for that hearing ran out. We raised during our testimony the problem of lack of notice. We were assured both by the chair of the committee as well as by a committee staff person who stepped into the hall to explain to me personally that certainly this was an oversight, it could never happen again, that they had had problems with scheduling, and there were, I believe, six or seven different people who were given the responsibility for not having given the notice. At the end of the meeting, I was informed there were still a number of the public interest groups who had not had an opportunity to give their testimony. Unfortunately, one of those people was a person who has spent the last 2 years working with these accommodation groups trying to reach some kind of a compromise. So they were reassured at that time that there would be an opportunity to participate, that they would hold a meeting and give notice for a week from that day. We watched closely in the journal. And unfortunately, a number of things evidently occurred because no notice was given of the subsequent meeting. We went relying on those reassurances. When we arrived there, the same people waited to testify. Suddenly, in the middle of the hearing, a motion was made to move the bill. Markup began, and people who had been waiting literally for hours in two different sessions were simply excluded from the hearing process. While we believe that this hearing that you've offered us today, Mr. Chairman, does give an opportunity to us who have that fortunate opportunity to be represented in Juneau, and that the teleconference will offer on Saturday, does at least lend some credibility back to the process. Unfortunately, the time frame with a totally new bill, with the major impacts this is going to have on so many constituent groups around the state, we feel it's unfortunate that even these opportunities will probably not provide an adequate chance for all of the concerns to be heard and for these contradictions internally within the Department of Law and Department of Natural Resources, let alone differences with some of us, to be resolved. I appreciate the time that you've given us.
Thank you, Mr. Ellison. Is there any questions? If not, thank you very much, Representative Besworth.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. You've made a number of allegations that this bill hasn't had proper hearing and hasn't been proper notification. Would you care to briefly state what you feel would be adequate hearings and adequate notifications? You seem to have some knowledge of the history of the bill, but I think it's still inadequate. But anyway, what would satisfy you as far as hearings?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Bettesworth, following the rules, I believe if the rules were followed, I think that would probably provide an adequate series of hearings and public input.
Are you stating possibly that the rules have not been followed as far as public hearings go on this bill?
Yes. I believe it's a matter of record, Representative Bettesworth, that there was no public notice for either of the. Now, of course, I'm not being a member of the body. I'm not as acquainted with the rules of this body as the members are. But it's my interpretation of the rules that I would say that when it says that there shall be 5-day notice prior to a public hearing in the first committee of referral, that that's what it means. And where that's not done, it's my interpretation that that means that the rules haven't been followed. I believe that an adequate hearing would mean that all of the interested parties and all of the potentially affected parties would have an opportunity to at least review and evaluate the bill. And if that means people all around the state, then I would say that probably an adequate hearing would mean that the people from around the state would have copies of the bill prior to the hearing, and that they would be given the opportunity to have it reviewed and analyzed, or to review and analyze it themselves, and then to make informed comments on the bill. That would be my recommendation. And again, as I say, I'm not that well acquainted with the rules of this body, but I was in the state legislature in the state of Indiana, and we had a somewhat similar rule, and it was rigidly adhered to. And we found that that generally provided adequate hearing.
It's rigidly adhered to around here, too. If it isn't, we hear about it.
I think you just did, Rex. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Would you again tell me what groups you represent? You gave a list here, and I didn't catch them all.
There are 11 groups, and I will do my best, Representative Chekwa, to make sure I include them all. It's the Northern Alaska Environmental Center, which is located in Fairbanks, the Alaska Center for the Environment, which is located in Anchorage, the Southeast Alaska Conservation Council, which is located in Juneau, the Lynn Canal Conservation Inc., which is located in Haines and has members in Skagway and throughout the northern southeast, the Audubon Society, the Sierra Club, the Wilderness Society,
Friends of the Earth.
Also represent Friends of the Earth. Each of the Alaska organizations, each of the national organizations, which does in fact have an office in Alaska, and all of the Alaska conservation and environmental organizations, the National Wildlife Society.
What sportsman's groups do you represent?
Mr. Chairman, I'm not done yet.
Excuse me, I'm sorry.
Thank you. You know, I was listening to your testimony there, and I developed the same feeling that I developed when I was a kid, and the fear of God was put in me back then by the missionaries, and so we changed our ways, and we've done away with dancing and those ritualistic spiritual activities that we used to perform. And then when I was in grade school, the teacher used to wash my mouth with soap for speaking Eskimo. At the time, I didn't know how to speak English. It's been rather interesting for me throughout my life career that other people have, for years, have imposed their own personal values, not necessarily from my own group of people, but people from outside of Alaska, in many cases. Against my personal will. And I'm beginning to get convinced, and I think a lot of people in Alaska are too, within my district, that they're tired of that activity of other people imposing their own personal values on or against the will of the people. And I think finally we're coming out of woodwork, and so therefore I would question your activity, whether it's right for me or whether it's wrong for me. And although there was a little sense of intimidation on my part, I'm not really that convinced people in my district would agree with you. You may be well aware of the disparity that exists in standard of living conditions between rural and urban Alaska. And people out there, in my view, are attempting to build a better quote-unquote quality of life in this age that we're finally catching on to. And so therefore, I would be a little more inclined to argue against your points. However, I will not take time, but I just want to express that sentiment of being upset on my part as a native fellow up here, that we basically are tired of other people trying to tell us what to do. So if it is the will of the public or my constituency, I would be inclined to follow that route.
If I may, Representative Chekwok, I would completely defer to you and agree with you that you and the people who live in your district are the people who should decide what happens in your district. And that is the position of our organization. One of the reasons that we oppose this legislation, Representative Chekwok, is because we see the right of you and the people who live in your district to make those decisions for themselves being taken away by the state bureaucracy.
Thank you.
Is one of our concerns.
Representative Chekwok? Yes.
Thank you very much, Mr. Ellison.
Thank you.
The last person we have to testify today is Molly Dent. Is there anybody else that would like to testify on Senate Bill 84? Okay. It will be the last one to testify. Would you state your name for the record, please?
Gentlemen, my name is Molly Dent. I'm an attorney with the Sierra Club Legal Defense Fund here in Juneau. I want to, first of all, thank you for the opportunity to come and present our comments on Senate Bill 84, and also to thank Representative Cotton for requesting the teleconference. We requested a teleconference on this bill when it was before the Labor and Commerce Committee the last time around. And so I think that was a very valid request. I submitted written comments, I believe, to each of you. I mailed them to you anyway about a week ago, and I hope you've received them. I would I would rather not read my written comments, especially due to the hour, and also believing that you will read them since I submitted them to you. I would like to take this opportunity, though, to just highlight a few of my comments on the bill. First of all, I'd like to say something about the history of the bill that's before you, because as I'm sure you're all aware, this is not the first time that the Alaska legislature has seen permit reform legislation. And I refer to it generically as permit reform legislation because there have been a series of permit reform bills with different numbers in different committees and that sort of thing. We oppose this bill as we've opposed previous permit reform legislation for basically three reasons, I suppose. The lack of public notice and opportunity for the public to participate in permit decision making, the failure of these bills to take advantage of the resources that exist in the state of Alaska in its resource agencies through interagency cooperation and through the agencies talking to each other about permit decisions. And the last aspect of this bill, as the other bills that we're concerned with, is the coastal consistency provisions of the bill. We believe that more attention needs to be paid to the local governments and to what people in specific localities have to say about what goes on in the localities than any of these bills have addressed. And another concern that we have that I don't think anyone else has raised to this point is the continued approvability of the Alaska Coastal Management Program. By that I mean that our concern with this legislation is that the federal government will decide that Alaska's coastal management program is not valid, and that the federal government will no longer have to listen to the state of Alaska when it makes decisions on federal lands and waters in Alaska. And I think that we think that that's a very, very important provision, and that inadequate attention has been paid to that aspect of this legislation thus far. And again, this is in response to Representative Chuckwuck's comments partially. It's not a matter of our telling people what to do. We want to be able to say what we think should be done, but in order for us to say what we think should be done on resource decisions, everybody has to have a say. So in that sense, we're trying to protect everybody's say. It is to protect ourselves and to protect our own ability to influence decisions, but we're protecting everybody's ability to get involved in the process. So, with respect to specific comments on this bill, first of all, this bill goes one step further than any previous bill the legislature has considered in terms of eliminating public participation, eliminating interagency cooperation, and possibly jeopardizing approvability of the Alaska Coastal Management Program, and limiting local control over coastal management decisions. One reason that I think that the history of permit reform legislation is sort of interesting is that when these proposals have come up before, the administration has made certain statements on the legislation that was before the legislature, and at one point, the Attorney General termed Senate Bill 84 as biased legislation. He said it contained a central provision that was unconstitutional. It was primarily designed to deny local governments and the public any involvement in most state permit decisions, that it threatened far more frequent litigation and had a far greater potential for project delay than existing law, and that it would coerce state agencies into denying a permit rather than letting a deadline run, and it would prevent them from reaching legally defensible decisions in complex cases. Now, the state attorney general said that about a previous permit reform bill that was in all major respects no different than this bill. And it is interesting, of course, that the administration's position on the bill has now changed. Similarly, the Federal Office of Coastal Management has informed the Attorney General's office that some of their proposed dealings with coastal consistency provisions through administrative regulatory efforts jeopardized continued approvability of the Alaska Coastal Management Program. And the provisions that the Office of Coastal Management objected to are in this bill in spades. And for people that aren't familiar with the Alaska Coastal Management Program, the bottom line, if the Coastal Management Program in Alaska is disapproved by the federal government, the bottom line is that the state of Alaska will have absolutely no say over what happens on federal lands in Alaska. They'll have absolutely no say over outer continental shelf oil and gas leasing, no say over timber sales on federal lands, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So that's one of the reasons I find the history of the bill of permit reform efforts interesting. To address specific provisions in this bill, the reason that we believe that public notice and interagency review are not provided for, first of all, the bill doesn't say anything about providing interagency review or public notice. It doesn't say you can't do it, but it certainly doesn't say you shall, and it doesn't say how it will be done. Secondly, by setting up the very arbitrary and very short deadlines that it does set up, it's very unlikely that most people are going to have an opportunity to know about permit decisions or participate in them, or that resource agencies are going to have any knowledge of permit decisions. And as far as specific deadline provisions in the bill go, the automatic issuance provision, it was pointed out that permits will be, if no action is taken on them within 30 or 60 days, permits will be automatically issued, and that permits that are automatically issued are not going to be looked at very highly by the courts. And that was a very pertinent comment. I've made that comment a number of times myself. I suggest to you that enacting legislation that the courts are not going to pay much attention to is probably not a very valid effort on the part of the legislature. I just don't know that you want to legislate in areas where the courts are going to have to interpret every word you say and you acknowledge are going to ignore it in many cases. Another provision another one of the deadline provisions on information and requests for additional information. The bill does provide for extension of a deadline where one request for additional information is filed, but if another request for information is filed, there won't be another extension. You need to keep in mind that the applicant for the permit supplies the information. The agency does not control the flow of information, and an applicant could simply not, could and in many cases does simply not provide sufficient information. So I would like to address one provision in the bill that I think is new since I prepared my written testimony, and that's the administrative appeal provision, and say that the idea of an administrative appeal by members of the public as well as by applicants is a good idea, we think. It should be open to both sides equally. However, the idea of overturning a decision to deny a permit and issue it automatically without any reason, which is in this bill right now, is not a good idea. Usually an agency is denied a permit for some reason, and to reverse that decision without any basis, without hearing the appeal, is not well-founded. So I think those are the end of my comments.
Thank you. Is there any questions? If not, thank you very much.
I would just like to make one comment, Mr. Chairman. You mentioned that House Committee Substitute 84 is going to eliminate the interagency cooperation, and I would just like to submit to you that I think there's been too much cooperation, and which has held up a lot of progress in this state. And I think if it is going to work that way, I'm all for it.
Is that a comment you want me to respond to, or is that just to me?
It's a free country, yeah.
Okay.
And to the administration, and I got into that when I was in the regulation review, and I saw a lot of trade-offs and things like they do in the legislature.
Well, one comment that I have in response to that is that the legislature has, for better or for worse, provided for various agencies to issue permits. And as long as those statutes are outstanding that require the permit, you're going to have those agencies making decisions on the permits, and to have the agencies working together, I submit, is a good idea, not a bad idea. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. The schedule for this week is tomorrow at 1:30. We'll do 7 bills, which will be announced on the floor tonight. We'll work on Saturday from 3:30 to 6 p.m., of which 4 to 6 p.m. is a teleconference on SB 84. On Sunday after the session, we'll pick up all amendments for SB 84 and hopefully move it out of committee on Sunday. There's nothing to come before Finance Committee. This is adjourned.
3:00
Let the record show that we have a quorum. The first bill this afternoon we'll take up is House Bill 101. It's related to motor fuel. We had this bill before us last week, and rules incorporate the language of the finance version of House Bill 37, which relates of motor fuel tax into House Bill 101. As you may recall, the bill was referred back to us on the floor the other day. It is now before the committee with one fiscal note requesting an appropriation and two which are informational purposes. The Department of Revenue indicate that in order for it to enforce Sections 1, 2, and 3 of Rules CS, $24,100 would be needed for an additional revenue auditor to audit the certifications. These sections would also result in an estimated loss of $1.4 million in revenues. Section 4 of the bill should generate $470,000 in additional revenues. We have here Representative Metcalf to testify on this bill.
Mr. Chairman, I would first dispute the fiscal note for the simple reason the department is assuming that it's going to receive funds from an audit that is currently underway. And it's my opinion and the opinion of others who have looked at the situation that the department clearly has changed the rules in midstream, is retroactively trying to change the name of the game, so to speak, and their actions will clearly be contested in court, and most probably the contestants will prevail. Mr. Chairman, I believe that most members of the committee here are quite familiar with the subject at hand, and therefore what I would do is maybe defer to others who might have testimony on this subject for the purpose of expedience. And I might further comment that I would like to follow up once that testimony is done. But I thought I should probably make comment on the accuracy or my perceived accuracy of the fiscal note that's been offered.
Is there any questions of Representative Metcalf? If not, thank you, Representative Metcalf. Is there anybody here to testify on House Bill 101? Commissioner?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Tom Williams. I'm the Commissioner of Revenue. House Bill 101 combines certain features that were earlier in House Bill 37 and House Bill 101. As the chairman already described them. It's not my intention here to go into the fiscal notes. I have been apprised by staff that there's a possible letter of intent that may accompany this, and I have been furnished a draft. Is it appropriate, Mr. Chairman, for me to comment on that?
No, it isn't at this particular time. The committee and myself have not seen the intent language you just pointed. It's coming, though. Yes.
Right here,
no. Oh, there it comes.
This is a rare occasion. Usually it's already passed by the time I get the letter.
We're working off the rules committee, so
yes, we are.
Then I'd like to comment on that, if I could, Mr. Chairman. A question has been raised with respect to the certificate of use, which is in Section 1 of the rules committee. This certificate of use is a sworn statement by the purchaser of the fuel that it will is not intended to be used as motor fuel, the fuel being so purchased. And a question has come up whether this needs to be a separate form or whether it could be on the invoice or receipt, the billing, that's given at the time the sale is made. Since there are thousands and thousands of these sales that go around the state, the department does not really have an objection to incorporating the certificate somehow into the form. However, we would it would facilitate our enforcement and our audit review of this if those invoices that have an executed certificate of use on them be identified and kept separately from others, so that you know, you don't have to paw through thousands and thousands of receipts where a tax was paid, but only need to go to those receipts where there was not in order to continue on the paper trail to find out whether, in fact, the fuel was used as motor fuel or not. With respect to Section 3 of the bill, Section 3, I think, is unconstitutional for two reasons. The first is that it's tantamount to lacks public purpose because you have dealers in different positions. Some dealers who have complied and paid taxes, and other dealers who have been caught in a situation not necessarily of their own creation and not for which they are to be blamed, but nevertheless in a situation where the tax is unpaid and it does not appear that the fuel was used for an exempt purpose or by an exempt entity. And so there is a tax due on that fuel. This Section 3 would prevent the Department of Revenue from enforcing the tax law with respect only to those people who have inadvertently found themselves, or perhaps advertently, find themselves having failed to comply with the tax laws of the state. It only benefits those who have not complied. It does not benefit those, obviously, who have. Therefore, it's not benefiting the entire class, and therefore, I think, lacks public purpose because the class is dealers. Also, it divides the class in an arbitrary fashion, treating those who have complied differently from those who have not complied, and that denies equal protection under the law. For those two reasons, if Section 3 remained in the bill and that's how it got presented to the governor, I would probably have to recommend a veto to him. The department is working with the audit division to try to resolve with the individual dealers involved their circumstances. We're working with their attorney. We're accepting affidavits about the fuel being used for exempt purposes or not being used for motor fuel. We're attempting to resolve it administratively. Section 3 is it's a gross way that attempts to make the situation go away and unfortunately fails to do so. And it attempts to, even if it did succeed, it would attempt to do so in an unconstitutional fashion. I'd be glad to answer any questions that you may have.
Representative Carney.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Commissioner, I'm looking at 43-40010, which talks about the responsibility of dealers, Section C. And I'm not looking at the bill, I'm looking at the statute in the book.
I'm sorry, I don't know that one.
Are you familiar with the section that deals with the responsibility of dealers in the sale of fuel?
Generally.
Well, it says here that at the time of sale, dealer who sells or otherwise transfers motor fuel in the state shall collect a tax at the time of sale. And under the definition of dealer, it says that it means a person who sells or otherwise transfers in this state motor fuel upon which the tax is imposed by this chapter has not been paid. Will you explain to me why that it wouldn't be then the responsibility of the wholesaler, the person who imports the fuel or refines it, why it isn't his responsibility to collect the fuel, since the definition plainly states that any fuel that's sold in the state of Alaska hasn't had the tax paid on it should be paid at that time?
No, I cannot. And the reason I cannot is because, unfortunately, and I'll apologize to the many for it, my own personal knowledge of this issue is essentially of a general nature. You know, the basic circumstances about how the problem arose, you know, generally what the issue is. I don't know jobbing. I don't know wholesaling. I won't pretend. Unfortunately, the people who, in the audit division, who are enforcing this, do have familiarity with it, are in fact in a training session and are not in town today.
Continue, Representative.
Chairman, as I understand it, the gentleman that's responsible for all of this activity is a new man in Alaska from North Dakota. I don't think he understands it either. And it's very, very clear to me, and I'm surprised that someone, before they took on such an action to punish people for alleged wrongdoing, that someone didn't clarify with the Attorney General to see if, in fact, these people are responsible for the collection of these taxes from the end user. You know, the original statute plainly called importers and refiners as users and specified that they were responsible for the tax. Now, because of some amendments, we're down to a dealer. But the definition of dealer says that when it's sold in the state of Alaska and the tax hasn't been paid, that that person has to collect the tax. And I think that this whole thing is
It's unfortunate because I don't think these dealers who distribute fuel are responsible for determining whether or not it's put in a vehicle or not. Their only responsibility should be to order and buy fuel from the man who's responsible for the tax, either diesel fuel or furnace oil, and then pay tax on that portion that they order as diesel fuel and not on the part that they order as furnace. If anyone is in violation of the law, Mr. Chairman, it would be the people who use the fuel that's bought as furnace oil and placed in internal combustion engines. So I think that this whole piece of legislation is unnecessary, but I'm trying to get clarification from Will Condon and Billy Barrett on that, and I would appreciate if the commissioner would work with me to try to find out if his staff is out of line.
As I say, we are attempting to deal with it administratively. I think one one statement that Representative Kearney made that I have to respectfully disagree with is I think it overstates and overly attributes blame to Mr. Kessel, who is the only person who has been brought in from outside the state in the last year. He's the director of the audit division, but he's not the one who initiated the audit. He's not the one who's made the audit findings. He is the director of the division, I suppose, in that sense, is responsible in the same way that I am on Deputy Commissioner of Taxation.
Well, I certainly apologize for attacking Mr. Kessler, but I do feel that the department is out of line in pursuing this action.
Representative
Cotton. I didn't have a question for Mr. Ray. I got someone offered a bill.
Any further questions of Commissioner Williams? No, thank you. Is there anybody from the public that would like to testify on House Bill 101? Representative Zaroff? Representative Zaroff, the one who will be testifying is the one who will have a committee substitute for House Bill number 101 rules.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, thank you.
For the record, your name?
For the record, Representative Zaroff, District 14. Mr. Chairman, of course, I was before the Finance Committee here a while back on House Bill 101, and at that time the contents of the bill was certainly much different than what we have before us today. And I would mention there that I have more concern, I suppose, than objection to the way that the bill is drafted now. I don't see any particular problems. I have some questions, but that's not my intent. Mr. Chairman, my intent for being here today would be to ask that the committee look at the work that the Rules Committee did to the bill that you passed out of this committee several weeks ago, and to ask yourselves if that is indeed the bill that was passed in this committee that you have now before you. I would suggest, Mr. Chairman, that certainly is not the bill that's before you. And to make it very similar to what you once had before, Mr. Chairman, I do have a number of, or two amendments, at least one major amendment, which I'll offer now for your consideration. And what these amendments do are, what this amendment would do, Mr. Chairman, would be to reinstate that portion that was taken out by the Rules Committee, which of course dealt directly with the marine fuel tax repeal. And I understand there were some problems with it before, and as I mentioned, it did pass from this committee to the Rules Committee. There were not a lot of favorable responses, but at least there was the intent there to move it along as it was. And I would ask that the committee look at this offered amendment and think favorably on reinserting them. The second amendment, which is actually the top page, Mr. Speaker, would deal with a problem that could be associated more with the bill as it is now in terms of some of the problems that the oil suppliers are experiencing now. If it were possible to include in the context of the, and this would expand the definition of as to what a non-fuel is, or motor fuel, The definition of motor fuel means basically any fuel used in an aircraft for the propulsion of motor vehicle or aircraft, or fuel used in and on watercraft for any purpose, or a stationary engine, machine, or mechanical contrivance which may run by an internal combustion motor. And then it goes on, fuel motor does not include, and it lists a number of items that are not included as motor fuel. And one item that I would call your attention to is fuel used in stationary power plants operating as public utility plants and generating electrical energy for the sale to the general public. This, Mr. Speaker, or Mr. Chairman, is fine. But there are a number of small households that have auxiliary generators, or people in remote areas that do have generators that are not covered under this particular exclusion. And the definition of motor fuel leaves them to pay a higher tax, of course, which is, I understand, is rebatable from the state if an individual makes application to do so. But in many cases, many people living in remote areas either don't go through the process or are not familiar with it. This amendment here would identify a stationary power plant generating electrical energy for the private residential consumption as part of the non-motor fuels, if you will.
Is there any questions of Representative Zara? Representative Cotton?
Yeah, I think it's a good amendment. Would you like the idea of making the tax off the watercraft or not? Since it's not on that list, it seems like they wouldn't be able to get rebated for it. Are you sure that they can get a rebate, even though they're not on the list?
It's my understanding there that they can get up to, somebody might correct me if I'm wrong, I think 6 cents per gallon or something, a rebate on that, if they make application for that.
The only reason you have this definition is because of the purpose of this section only, right? This definition of motor fuel for the purpose of this taxation.
Yes.
So,
is there any more questions of Representative Zaro? Thank you, sir.
Thank you.
Don't go away, because I'm going to take up your two bills right after this one. Is there anybody in the audience that would like to testify on House Bill 101 before the chair accepts amendments? If not, the chair at this time will entertain any motions we have pertaining to amendments on this bill. Representative Cotton.
Yes, Chair, I'll offer the amendments put back in the original language this committee approved that would repeal the tax on motor fuel each entered on watercraft. I'd ask you now to accept that amendment.
Is there objection? Yes, Representative McCaffrey, Mayor. Do you have a set of the amendments, Representative McCaffrey?
Mr. Chairman, I had conferred with the maker or the original proposer of the amendment prior to the proposal and said that I would look into the probability of eventual passage of the bill in the event the amendment were adopted. And also told that party that it did not impede the probable ultimate passage of the bill, that I would support that amendment. And in any case, I have looked into that. What the situation boils down to, Mr. Chairman, are these gentlemen represent a very large segment, not all of the motor fuel dealers within the state, most of them small companies, truckers, people with own 1, 2, 3 trucks. Truck drivers hauling fuel. And what the department is attempting to do, and I don't know of anybody that sat down and spoken with them yet that hasn't agreed, the department is clearly wrong. And that
what the department is doing is a little bit bizarre. And what the department is attempting to do would bankrupt a very large number of these fuel dealers. And in discussions that have taken place at this point, it's made clear to me that it was the department's intent to audit all 52 dealers. And this would literally put half of the dealers in this state out of business. You're talking about more money than they make in a year or 2 years coming back to the state in their request. So I therefore place a great deal of importance on the ultimate passing of this piece of legislation. I think that there's an awful lot at stake for an awful lot of people, which is why I looked into the question. There were members of the legislature who clearly had the ability to do so that said if the amendment that's been proposed, referring to fuel tax for watercraft fuel, were added to this bill, then this bill would die. And that word came from members of this legislature that have the ability to back that up. And therefore, Mr. Speaker, or Mr. Chair, Representative Cotton.
I don't think this kind of testimony is in line. I don't think it's a
split debate. Would you keep your debate to the two amendments that were taken up at this time, Representative?
That will conclude my comments on the First Amendment. The Second Amendment that is being proposed that I've seen, and I don't believe it's been moved yet, amendment, I doubt that that would be as controversial and would not be prepared to make a comment at this time, although I do know that the addition of this amendment would ensure that this problem, the First Amendment proposed, would ensure that the problem is not resolved.
So any questions, Representative Cotton? Any questions of Representative McCaff? There was a motion was made before you to approve both amendments, Representative Cotton. Or did you want to take them both?
I'll put them both on at the same time. I feel like I'm not sure what's going to happen. What's going on at the time? I just offered the main amendment, which is the contents of the original House Bill 101 that this committee passed out. Apparently, that inadvertently left out when the Rules Committee said it put different substitutes there.
I'd appreciate it if you'd take these amendments one at a time.
Right. Yeah, I'd just point out that, I think the last testimony might not have been completely in order. The result is that the original bill and the original sponsors, the original bill is the one that's dying now. He needs to be concerned about his bill dying, and this is attached to it. Well, this one's dead if we don't. So I have my sympathy for his problem.
The first motion Representative Cotterfield will make is the new section B.
Three-page amendment.
Okay. The three-page amendment is the one you'd like to take up first. Representative Bettisworth.
Was there an objection to the amendment all brought in?
There was objection. There was an objection from Fuller.
If I may, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Bettisworth.
We're addressing the three-page amendment, which eliminates tax on marine fuel or watercraft, so forth. This may be a good idea, and perhaps we do need to reduce the taxes, but if the committee chooses to adopt that resolution, then I'm going to offer another amendment to reduce the highway fuel tax by 2 cents a gallon.
Representative Huntington Chipoff.
I guess I'm not certain what direction to take on this. I'm supportive of both issues, and I've always been against piggybacking issues, and looks like we're doing that with this kind of amendment, and I certainly understand the problem of trying to get the original issue back on with its own title and its own number. I don't have an answer. I just have to express that dilemma.
Representative Chickler.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I don't know if this is proper procedure or even a procedure here. We've dealt with this particular issue already, and we have obviously the content of the bill has changed, and the maker of the amendment is attempting to put it in for the second time, when in fact we have dealt with it already.
That is correct, but any amendments that anybody, any legislator would want is acceptable. Right? And I didn't realize what's happened. Representative Cotton.
All right. What will happen, Joe, is that once the bill gets calendared, the bill is in front of the body of House Bill 101. So at that point, somebody makes a motion to accept one of the committee substitutes as an amendment. So either it would accept it, depending on what the majority leader moves, either the Rules CS or the Finance CS, or maybe the second Finance CS that will contain both issues. But right now, as it stands, most likely that what normally happens is the majority leader moves the most recent version, which would leave the original House Bill 101 in the lurch. So if the Finance Committee decided to come up with a second committee substitute, then that might be the compromise to, you know, put both issues together, and hopefully that would be the substitute version that would move.
Representative Chipper.
Mr. Chairman, I realize that procedure there. I don't have any problems with it. Obviously, the person is the maker of the amendment is insistent that we readopt what we've already thrown out the door. I don't know. I guess my question is, can we allow, or are we allowed to go that through that procedure again a second time around and see what happens? Seems to me I've heard somewhere that it was not allowed.
It is allowed at this time because this particular bill was kicked back off the floor back to finance, and that's why we have it before us again today. Representative Cully, you have questions?
Well, I was just going to say to Representative Cuddy, I don't know if it'll help him any or not, because Sharov can't say it, but he's smiling. Don't agonize, because that's exactly what I did to Sharov. So,
because
helping
what?
Your vote. Piggybacking. Stripping.
Is that different?
Okay. Yeah. Well, it's the same difference. You know, it's a matter of form.
Representative Carney?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Well, when the bill was in this committee originally, I proposed an amendment to have deleted the fuel tax on all fuel, and that did not pass. And I feel, as Representative Bettesworth does, that if we're going to pass legislation that decreases fuel taxes, it should be across the board for all fuel. And for that reason, I was opposed to the original bill, so it doesn't bother me as much to take this title and use it for a very, very, very important purpose, because I think a lot of people were opposed to that. I don't think it would have passed the House and Senate anyway. So, and these people who have a problem with this tax situation are in a crisis situation. It's very important this legislation passed, and I wouldn't want to tack anything on it that would have any influence on whether or not it would final pass.
Is there any more debate on the motion? Representative Cotton?
Yeah, just that it isn't uniform now, the different tax levels on fuel. It's 8 cents for highways, 4 cents for avgas, 5 cents for watercraft, and 2.5 for 88 for other gasoline. So it's all over the board right now. And what we're saying here, I think, is that we're going to give a break to the watercraft fuel users, and it's a matter of possibility whether or not you want to extend a, you know, a similar reduction to other users or not. It's no secret that the people that are making their living on boats these days have got some pretty tough times ahead of them over the next couple of years, especially now that they're finding some additional problems in the salmon selling business.
Question has been called for. All in favor of the amendment signified by raising your hand. Opposed? Motion fails. Representative Cotton?
Yeah, I'm moved that the second amendment now would have to just put in another section that would just add to the definition of motor fuel a new, in this case, G, that would describe the situation that Representative Zara spoke of, where the people that have the standby generators or permanent source power are generated, they shouldn't be having to pay a highway or any other type of user tax for that type of use. So I'm going to ask unanimous consent we have this section of the bill. Section 6 that would put the 4340-1002 definition section in the bill and add one that you see on the center page here as a.
I'll object just for clarification, Mr. Blackman. Would you like to put that D under definitions, under page 1, under section 2, and just make that description? Zairoff has it listed as D.
Just that right now, the way it is in law right now, unless, I think it's 4340-102, that is that's the definition section in the statutes, so I think that's where you have to put it. Maybe I'm missing something.
Okay. Could you repeat your motion, but the sponsor is nodding, that's okay.
So the drafting style, it would require you to print that whole section, even though you only wanted to add that one new definition.
Okay.
So I'm going to ask the next section to that.
Yeah. So if there's objection to the amendment? Any further debate on the question?
Question.
Question has been called for. All in favor of the motion, signify by raising your hands. Opposed? Motion fails. You have before you.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Cotton.
What was the vote?
4-5.
It was 5-4.
In favor of defeating it.
Well, the motion was the passive amendment, not the
defeating. Yeah. And it failed, 5-4. Would you like another count on that?
Okay.
The motion before you is to adopt the amendment number 2, which is the definition on fuel. All in favor of that motion, signify by raising your hand.
Mr. Chairman, I'm still confused.
I'm confused on that.
Okay. The motion was made by Representative Cotton on this one-page sheet here.
Okay, we voted it once. We're voting it again.
Yeah, we're voting it again because of the fact that there was confusion on the count. I counted 4 yes and 5 nays on that particular last count. The motion before you is all in favor of amendment number 2. Please signify by raising your hand. Opposed? The opposite. Motion passes. I'm ready to entertain a motion at this time for a committee substitute for House Bill number 101. Representative Cotton, I'll entertain a motion to move this up.
Move the bill out.
Is there any objection?
I'd like to
ask you now.
Yeah, I'd like to move the letter of intent at some point.
Okay, right after this. No objection. Representative Carney.
Chairman, I'd like to move and ask unanimous consent for the adoption of the letter of intent that's been distributed to members.
Is there any objection? Letter of intent will go along with House Bill 101.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Cotton?
I think that Representative Montgomery should have told the committee how they should have done the technical session. What they did was they just dyed the gas purple or orange or something like that. They're going to use it on the farm, so we can go through all this stuff.
Yeah. It worked real well, seriously.
Exactly right.
Yeah, they
figured that out in Kansas after a while.
Yeah.
Order. The next two bills we'll hear up is House Bill 464 and House Bill 465. House Bills 464 and 465 has been sponsored by Zairoff. Representative Zairoff.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the Finance Committee. Representative Zairoff, District 14. I'm here before you on House Bills 464 and 465. One is the enabling legislation, the other is an appropriation. The enabling legislation 464, I'll try to be as brief as possible, as we've had extensive hearings in the HES committee and also the, I guess we didn't have it on the subcommittee, but I do appreciate the subcommittee chairman dealing with this. Mr. Chairman, this legislation there addresses problems there that we have in our
school systems throughout the state, not in terms of meeting negative problems, Mr. Chairman, but problems there that often go undetected, and those are problems that deal with vision and hearing of various children as they go through the educational process. And as you are aware, Mr. Chairman, if we do not detect these problems at an early stage, the child going through the educational process can very easily be left out, and oftentimes we find there that they have failed or become problems, and not because they can't cope with the situations, that they can't see properly or they cannot hear correctly. And what this legislation here would do would set up a program there throughout the public school system. And I might add, Mr. Chairman, that recollection on my part tells me that in the HESS committee there was a motion to delete public and have it apply to all schools, private and public throughout the state, so that the problem would be taken care of statewide. And the cost for taking care of the private schools was not that much. We have people from HESS that can attest to that probably with more knowledge than I. But the purpose here would be to identify children who have vision or hearing problems, also to inform the parents of each child who fails the screening of these tests that would create potential problems, and then also the recommendations to the parents as to how to correct these problems, either through professional examinations or whichever. To refer children who have vision and hearing impairments for evaluation and educational and communication implications for the hearing and loss impairments. Also to inform the child's teacher of any of these difficulties, which is often important in the placement within the classroom and dealing directly with the children or child. To maintain records as to the status of these children as they move through. I believe in the packet of information that you have, there are the various grade levels that were identified as key points to focus in on as to where and when these evaluations should be made. To maintain the records of the overall screening program activities and to complete any forms there that would be needing in transferring students back and forth so that their records would move with them and they would be completed at the end of the year. Most, I believe, of the school districts would not have a problem in regards to this piece of legislation. In fact, we've had considerable amount of support in this. The funding, I think, that was required for the screening, based on figures from the Department of Education, was approximately $3 per student. And I think the total fiscal impact on this one was roughly $270,000, somewhere in there. I think possibly if there is a financial crunch and the funding mechanism is not there for this, I think the important consideration should be given to the implementation of this type of a program so that we get this program going. And I don't know where the money would come to implement it. Either it would be absorbed by the local school districts or found somewhere within the Department of Education or Health Social Services or administration. I don't have a ready answer for that. The simplest one, of course, would be just to fund it directly.
Okay, Representative Kiney.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Lieutenant Zoff, in your testimony on this legislation, was there any discussion given to the present law that requires children to have physical examinations before they can enter the school?
I believe there was, but I think that's just a one-time shock. When you enter kindergarten there or first grade or you get in your first wrestling match, you have to have your normal physical examination. But if you'll notice, the
on the back of... did you get one of these packets?
I have one.
Okay. The screening was put together on a staggered basis here. The vision examinations would take place in kindergarten or grade one, and then third, fifth, seventh, and twelfth grades after that. And then the hearing process or hearing screening would take place in kindergarten or grade one, and then two, three, seven, and 11, after which this would be kind of an ongoing program rather than just going into the one-time physical, which sometimes does not detect those problems that the child may develop there in his early years in education.
Continue, Mr. Chairman. Well, it's been my experience that physicals for children normally don't, isn't much more than the check of the ears and eyes and a couple other little pokes and prods. And I'm wondering if this legislation passed, if we could repeal the law that requires students to have physical examinations before they enter school. A lot of people can't afford that. It'd be my guess that those who can't afford it are the ones that would be picked up by this program, and of course the ones that have physicals probably wouldn't need the program. So if we decide to pass the legislation, was it discussed in HESS committee at all?
Of repealing the existing?
Yeah.
Not to my knowledge.
One of the statements that you made in your testimony that you wanted to perhaps have somebody from the committee make an amendment and include private schools, public and private schools, because in the HESS committee, I think you guys were waiting for a legal opinion on this particular issue. Is that correct?
That could very well be. Any questions?
Just one question. Representative Jaroff, if you did put an amendment on that, then we're going to have another fiscal note, is that correct?
I think that the amendment there that related to the public school, that the fiscal impact on that was not that substantially great. I think we have a bowl here from the Department of Health Social Services that could answer that directly.
Representative Montgomery.
Mr. Chairman, the intent might be great, but I'd be very reluctant to go along with that amendment until we had a written, clear, legal definition. If you remember some years ago back, that question came up on transportation of students. It went through the whole course, from private versus public school. And so I think you would weaken this unless you had a clear, written definition as to the legality of that.
I think the intent here, Representative Jonery, was, you know, is to identify problems that children could have, particularly which would affect them later on in life and could cause other problems there that are unforeseen, and that was to detect the hearing and vision problems that they would have at an early stage, whether they were in a private school or whether they were in a public school. I agree with you. There are some problems there that could legally come about legally.
Representative Cotton?
Yeah, I concur.
Okay.
You
don't mind?
No, I don't.
Okay, is there any further questions? Thank you, Representative Zara.
Thank you.
What's the pleasure of the body?
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Cotton.
If you're ready to vote on both bills, I'll
yes.
ask unanimous consent that the Finance Committee pass out the CS for Health Bill 464 and CS for Health Bill 465.
With those two fiscal notes, also naming $76,500 for the vision consult position,
$109,900.
Yeah,
well,
that's
not a fiscal.
No, that's fine. That's not a disappropriation. Is there any objection? If not, 464 and 465 is moved out of finance. The next one we're going to take up is Senate Bill 548. Senate Bill 548 Finance, originally sponsored by Senator Coletta, made several amendments to the Medical Indemnity Corporation of Alaska, which was created in 1976 to provide for medical malpractice insurance for Alaska physicians
and hospitals. If such analysis containing a bill file, the fiscal notes and division of insurance indicate the cost of legislation is zero. So anybody here to testify on committee substitute for Senate Bill 548? Would you state your name for the record?
Mr. Chairman, I'm Dennis DeWitt. I'm the president of the Alaska State Hospital Association. I have with me Mr. William Brock, who's a member of the board of MICA. As you indicated, there is a fiscal, there is a sectional analysis and a fiscal note of zero. We could either elaborate or respond to questions, whichever is your preference.
What's the pleasure of the body?
What's, maybe you could just answer it, like, I see that on the front page, you've got the whole thing, the sheet here, I'm not sure you put this thing together, the sectional analysis, you put this together, is that your staff? Is there anybody, is there any controversy over this?
Senate did this.
Mr. Chairman, responding to Representative Cotton, there is no controversy. There was a small question of language which was worked out in the Senate side, and so far as we know, our association supports it, MICA supports it, the insurance division supports it, and the insurance companies support it, and the those that are receiving their insurance through MICA support. So.
Was there, did it go to another committee in the House?
Yes, it's been to Labor and Commons.
No fiscal?
No. What's the pleasure of the body, please? Representative. Is there any objection? Committee substitute for Senate Bill 548, finances moved out.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you very much. The next one we'll take up is House Bill 635. House Bill 635 is sponsored by Representative Fanning. It provides that the implement of husbandry is not subject to motor vehicle registration requirement. It also enables the Department of Public Safety to issue a special permit to drive or move the vehicle on the highway for more than 40 miles if the vehicle exceeds DOT's established limitations. It also provides that the operator of the vehicle need not display flags, signs, or other warning devices, or have the vehicle proceed or followed by a pilot vehicle when driven or moved a mile or less. The Transportation Committee adopted a committee substitute which does require that an implement of husbandry display flags, signs, or other warning device when it is driven or moved on a highway. It also does not exempt implements of having a pilot vehicle when driven or moved a mile or less in the original bill. The requirements for posted signs is also deleted. DOT is also required to post signs along each highway in agricultural areas warning of the possibility use of the highway by oversized implements of husbandry. The Department of Transportation indicate a $35,000 cost for the CS due to the cost of posting the required signs along the highways. The Department of Public Safety indicated zero fiscal note on the original bill. Is anybody here to testify on House Bill number 635? Yeah, he left. What's the pleasure of the body?
Move,
Mr. Chairman.
Yes, Representative.
Yes, I would move the bill.
Is there any objection to move out House Bill 635? For the fiscal note, no objections. The next one we'll take up is Senate Bill 746. 746 is sponsored by the Senate Resource Committee, appropriates $150,000 for production of a documentary film on Alaska's mining history and potential. In addition, it also appropriates $26,000 to cover the cost of the Alaskan athletes in the Arctic Winter Games. The Department of Commerce and Economic Development has prepared a fiscal note for the same $150,000, which is appropriated in the legislature. Is there anybody here to testify on Senate Bill 746? If not, what's the pleasure of the group? Representative Cotton.
What's the $150,000 to get a movie? Is that it? to move it forward.
Representative Tedesco.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. Mr. Cotton, perhaps at this stage in Alaska's history, it's probably significant that this came up at this time. The Alaska Mining Congress, which is an association of all the nation's mines and miners and so forth, has a every four-year convention rather than annually like most people do. They're pretty poor outfit. But anyway, it is the interest of the mining industry in Alaska, the School of Mineral Industry at the University, and others, Senator Fahrenkamp in particular and myself, in making known to the United States in particular the assets that we feel Alaska has in the way of natural resources other than oil and gas. And since we are experiencing declining revenues from oil and gas, if we can successfully promote the development of some of our large mineral deposits, it would go a long ways towards hiring a lot of Alaskans and also picking up some of the revenue losses that we're going to experience from now on the oil and gas declines. We have the potential in Alaska, known deposits for two or three world-scale mines of your base metals, lead, zinc, copper, and sulfides run 6, 7, 8%. Most ores that are exported in the world run 2 or 3%. We have other deposits in the state similar to the McCarthy copper deposit that are not being utilized. And coal, we talk about energy and BTUs. There's 50 crude oil bays across the inlet from where you live in the form of BTUs and coal. Not one big crude oil bay, but 50 right there. And it's time that Alaska got off of this one source revenue economy. And for $150,000, will be shown the first time at the American Mining Congress Convention in October in Las Vegas. After that, copies of the film will be made available for documentary use nationwide, schools, university, colleges, for promotion and so forth. And for only $150,000. It'll do more for Alaska than that $2 million during the Super Bowl did.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Where was this promotions for, you say? Representative Ben's for us.
Pardon?
What was this promotions for?
Some of us feel that there's a lack of factual knowledge about Alaska and its resources, and one of the best places to start disseminating that information would be at the Mining Congress their convention, which takes place every 4 years.
For?
To promote and make known to the world, you might say, the resources that we have in Alaska that are available.
For?
Development.
We want to turn Billingham into a beluga coal field, okay?
What's the pleasure of the group?
Mr. Chairman, I move and ask unanimous consent that the bill be passed out of committee.
Is there any objection? Not. The committee substitute for Senate Bill number 746, Finances Committee. The last bill we'll take up today is House Bill 757, sponsored by Rules at the request of the Governor, makes a number of changes in the state's unemployment insurance program. Some of these changes include requiring the Employment Security Division to share information regarding unemployment insurance claims with state or federal agencies which administer the food stamp program. It requires the Employment Security Division to withhold from payments of the claimant's benefits the amount the claimant owes for child support obligations and to pay that money to the child support enforcement agency. It also prohibits disqualifications of an individual while attending vocational training courses and increases the unemployment insurance weekly benefit amount. In addition, the bill makes other amendments necessary to comply with recent federal enactments. The Labor and Commerce Committee adopted a CS which makes several other changes, including decreasing the maximum benefit from $166 proposed in the original bill to $156. It is currently $150, and sets up a program of supplement state benefits. Fiscal note from the Department of Labor indicates a cost of $160,400 in FY83 for the CS. This will cover the additional programming service due to the increased benefit amounts.
The supplement state benefit system will require funds for data processing development costs. The Department of Health and Social Services indicated zero fiscal impact. The original bill showed a cost of